Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Now, I want to talk with Barbara Sharon. She's written a book called Access All Areas, a backstage pass through 50 years of music and culture. She was a music journalist, then a publicist at Warner Brothers Records, and she's now written a personal, insightful and pretty funny memoir packed with stories of being on the cultural front line, basically. So, Barbara, welcome to the programme. Firstly, what's the difference between a publicist and a press officer?
Nothing, really. They're the same.
They're the same thing. OK. But at the same time, if you're given those two titles, a publicist is there to just, you know, give publicity of any sort to the artist that they're looking after. But a press officer, it's not specifically just the press.
You said publicist any sort, and that's not really the case. I mean, publicist, PR, whatever you want to call it. There's a selective process that goes on, and I think the people that are good at their job choose wisely.
Okay, but like you do go back to a day, not with a quill or a pen and ink, but you do go back to the typewriter driven by Tippex, etc. And that's when you were writing your articles when you came from Chicago to London and started working for Sounds magazine.
Yes. I also wrote a book on a typewriter, authorized biography of Keith Richards. There was no computers in those days and no internet. So you had to do all your own research.
Well, then let's jump right in, since you've mentioned Keith. One of the things, sometimes something happens and it's just almost a piece of luck in some ways. When you were writing the book on Keith, was that the same time as the Toronto drug bust? And if so, did that help for free publicity?
Yes. So the originally Keith had suggested that I go to Canada. They were going to do a series of club gigs for a live album, which was pretty much the only thing they were doing that year to kind of kickstart the book. And as it happened, he did get arrested in Canada and had to stay for a month while that was all sorted out. Eventually there was a trial and his sentencing was to do a concert for the blind, which is probably one of the more bizarre outcomes of a court case ever. But the whole thing in Canada kind of set the framework for the book.
Yeah, it's called Keith, Life as a Rolling Stone. You spent like a long time with him, many times with him. Was he annoyed at you at any stage at all when you wrote a review once and said at the end, this could be the last time?
Yeah, no, I wrote a cover story for an American magazine called Crawdaddy about the Stones, and I was trying to be too clever for my own good, and this was 1975, mind you.
Yeah.
And I ended the piece. They were touring at the time, saying this could be the last time, which is so ironic because it's 2022, and I'm going to see them live on Saturday in Hyde Park.
Exactly. That kind of sums it up all right. No question about it. I remember they played here even in 1991, and people were talking about the Strolling Bones and talking about Zimmer frames and all the rest of it.
It's a great testimony to Keith, I think, that he actually called me out on that.
Yeah.
And a really good lesson I learned early.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's all in jest, really. It doesn't, I mean, it shouldn't matter. I mean, Keith has a very stable family life. He's a cultured man, an intelligent man. He's a funny guy. Do you find that a lot of people would never think along those lines when it comes to Keith Richards?
Yeah, absolutely. Not so much now, but certainly then.
Yeah, of course, obviously. I mean, now also, by the way, he mentions the substance abuse in the book. He never glorifies it. It's just, it just is what it is.
Exactly.
And so he was happy to sort of be the man he was all the time, and still is, by the way. And by the way, he will outlast us all, as you well know. Now, I might as well jump in with some more names, because one of the biggest names of all is, from the very beginning, is Madonna. I mean, you were working with Madonna from before anybody ever really heard of her, weren't you?
Yeah, I was working at Warner Brothers in the press office, and she was spending some time in the UK. She used to do the Beetroot Club on Greek Street, not too far from our office on Broadwick Street. And then she also did that infamous performance on the Tube a couple months later. But she did a show at Coco, which used to be the Camden Palace, where she did like a 20-minute set. And then the next time she played in London, she played Wembley Stadium to 100,000 people. which is just like a phenomenal achievement that will never be repeated, going from a small club to Wembley Stadium with nothing in between.
And even like in 1991 or 1992 or thereabouts, she was just so famous that when she released that sex book, I mean, like the palaver, the nonsense around that whole thing, and the crowds and the streets cut off in London.
Yeah, bookstores opened at midnight and it was like on the 10 o'clock news. It was crazy.
But I mean, you do say in the book, and by the way, we're talking about Access All Areas, a backstage pass through 50 years of music and culture with Barbara Sharon. Barbara, you do say in the book that like one of the things about Madonna, compared to some of the people you've worked with, and look at the list I mentioned earlier on that you work with, that like she really understood everything about the value, in particular in all of those early years, of publicity.
Yeah, I think she understood. I mean, she's got a great sense of herself, and I think any great artist has a sense of themselves and their image and their personality. Just everything comes from them, I find, in the best artists.
Is all publicity good publicity?
No.
Was all publicity good publicity for Madonna?
You know, I don't think all publicity is good publicity for anyone. You know, our jobs as working behind the scenes is to try and position the artist in the best possible light in with journalists that they, you know, we think they'll get along with and in a paper that they think is good.
And would you ever sit in on an interview with a journalist and a rock star?
No, I don't think, I'm not a believer in sitting in on interviews or having managers sit in on interviews. You know, I think it's difficult enough. The artist and the journalist are supposed to get a sense of each other in a very short time, and you really don't need a third party there to make things, you know, more difficult.
And have you ever said to a journalist, look, don't ask them about this, that, or the other?
Yeah, you know, I think personal things in people's personal life, they have the right to decide when to talk about, you know, like marriage, being pregnant, for example. You know, now, obviously, with Instagram, artists pretty much decide what they want to say on a daily basis.
And do you think with Instagram and with all of social media, and above all, even with Zoom, that a lot of artists don't need what your experience was? I mean, like, they don't need publicists.
I think there's two different things between Instagram and publicists. I can't see an artist getting their own albums reviewed or their concerts reviewed, or ringing up The Guardian and asking if they'll do an interview.
No, indeed. And by the way, like when you say The Guardian, there is a bit in the book where Madonna's on stage and she's wearing a mic on one side and that, and people used to be able to sit in the pit at the beginning and take pictures at the very beginning of a concert, and you'd make those photographers you didn't like take the side where the microphone was going to be shown, and The Guardian and the others you liked were on the other side. That's a nice bit of power, isn't it?
Well, you know, everything, we have to take it as it comes.
And it worked for you. Like, what about the pandemic time? I mean, did you sit down and listen to all old albums again, just get back to who you used to be?
Yeah, I mean, during you know, I still work. I have a PR company, NBC, yeah. And we had a lot of artists that had albums coming out, even though there were no tours. But obviously, we weren't as busy. No one was as busy as normal life. And there were no, you know, we used to go to 2-3 gigs a week. And obviously, for a good 18 months, touring pretty much stopped. But yeah, I did. I went back and played a lot. Just fell in love with my record collection again.
And also, like, there's so many different names in the book also that I mentioned earlier on, from Prince to Rod Stewart, Foo Fighters. R.E.M. was a very big one for you. In fact, let's stick with R.E.M. for a second, because one of the things about R.E.M. was they released two albums that between them sold about 25 million copies or something, and all they did was sit on the veranda back in Athens, Georgia. In other words, they didn't tour, and Michael Stipe didn't do any interviews.
No, but Mike Mills and Peter Buck came to England a lot across those two albums, Out of Time and Automatic for the People. So they did, but no, they didn't tour, and Michael didn't do any interviews. And in normal circumstances, that would work against you.
Yeah.
But actually, it made them more popular.
Yeah, like a little
bit. But they were two very good albums.
Yeah, they were, and they were good, and they were two very good interviewees, but they weren't the lead singer, which is what people wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, now you do mention also just of some meals that you've been out on with like some people that I'd be fascinated by. Yeah, like, just what was Randy Newman like?
Oh, Randy Newman was kind of exactly as you'd want him, a little bit shy, very acerbic, very smart.
Yeah, he certainly is. And obviously I'll have to ask Joni Mitchell.
Oh, Joni Mitchell was actually so much, she was warm, friendly, beautiful smile, quite engaging.
And then what about being on a bus going to Donington with a bunch of metal bands? What was that like?
I know, I would go up and down the aisle. Well, I worked at the time when I worked at WEA, Atlantic Records had a lot of heavy metal. And they used to have the first band on and the last band off. So I'd have to get up about, we'd leave London at 9 o'clock in the morning. I'd get coffee and croissants and they'd be like chowing down on sulfate.
Yeah, right, exactly. And like you were able to get them there. And was it your job to, even once you did get there, to literally get them up on stage?
No, what, the artists?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, no.
Right. That's road managers and all the rest of it, yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you need to have for this job is, I presume, you have to love, not just like, love the music.
Yeah, I think the more you love music, the better you are at, you know, any part of working in the music business.
And like, did you find managers were often quite difficult, quite demanding?
You know, these days I think it's as important to like the manager as the artist because, you know, we all work as a team so closely together. But most people are pretty reasonable, especially if you're, I think the good thing is to be realistic in terms of what you can achieve and honest about what you can achieve.
Do you know, like what you achieved, you were working in a record store and... In Wally King's record store, and
as a part-time job,
And you also, like you said, listen, I think I'll get into this writing about music thing. I quite like it. So you write at the Chicago Sun Times, James Taylor article or something along those lines. Fire and Rain was big at the time. It got printed, and you realised this is easy, and that's how that's how you got into the whole thing for writing for like the biggest of magazines, from NME to Rolling Stone. Is it?
Yeah, I had a column in my high school newspaper, and used to write about music. And then started writing for the Chicago paper, which was, you know, seeing my byline was amazing. It was very exciting.
And being an American in England, I presume, was an advantage, was it?
Yes.
Because you seem to have taken to England in a huge way. I mean, not just the Chelsea Football Club that's in the book, but so much more. Like, you really have.
Well, I grew up, you know, all those... going to see A Hard Day's Night and watching The Man from U.N.C.L.E. on TV and James Bond movies, you know, I fell in love with the taxis and the red double-decker bus and the red post boxes, you know, Waterloo Bridge. So when I got, you know, America's a relatively new country. So when I came to England, all the history, I had a real romantic view of it.
And before that, back home, Chicago direction, I mean, you go to your first concert, probably Herman's Hermits, but you really went to see the support band, the Hollies.
I bought my sister tickets to Herman's Hermits for Christmas, even though she didn't really like them, just so I could go see the Hollies, yeah.
And do you remember the gig, do you?
Vaguely. I'm not sure if that was my first concert. I used to spend all my money on concert tickets and records.
Because, like, the way you say it in terms of, you know, America was what it was at the time. So if America, for instance, was Paul Revere and the Raiders, the England was the Beatles. I take the Beatles any day of the week. you were 11 years of age at that stage.
Yeah, when the Beatles first came out, yeah.
And British culture then meant an awful lot to you. So what about your father? I mean, he was in, like, he's in the book quite a bit in terms of, you know, he is sick and he is dying towards, you know, certain parts of it. But in that story, your father would have liked kind of the more new Christy Minstrels maybe and all that. But one of the people, or maybe, I don't know, Bobby Darin, Mac the Knife was your first single, but he liked Tommy Makem, did he, in the Clancy Brothers?
Yes, he did.
In what way? Like, would he have had records?
Well, probably one of the first folk music was really big in America around the time of Peter, Paul and Mary, and before that, the New Christy Minstrels, Chad Mitchell Trio, and yeah, my dad did really like Tommy Makem.
Yeah, and he
we went when we first came over to England on a family trip to Europe. We went to London, Liverpool, Liverpool for some reason, which obviously I was excited about, and Dublin.
Oh,
in fact, we rented a car in Dublin that could only, I think it couldn't go in reverse.
You know, there's a funny bunch of stuff in the book about cars and different types of cars that you had. And one of them, well, let me get this right now. It was a second-hand something or other that you bought off the manager of Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
Yeah, a blue Datsun.
So you're not like the orange mini metro, whatever it was. That was the first.
Yeah, that I had in Chicago.
Right, and also when like the sport, you went to see Wimbledon, and you wangled your way into loads of different matches in Wimbledon. And you saw the famous McEnroe Borg match, didn't you?
Yes, I did, with a very large man from Texas sitting next to me, high up the top of Wimbledon, and it was really humid.
And what you're trying to say
it was a great match, though.
It was a very long match, and you fell asleep now and again, did you?
A little bit too much champagne.
Right, okay. In fact, there's a lot of imbibing of various substances throughout the book, but you seem to have come through it all, haven't you?
Absolutely, 100%.
Right, okay. Neil Young, tell me about Neil Young.
Neil Young, when I was working at Warner Brothers, we used to take, key people from the label would take an artist out to dinner when they were in doing promo, and Neil Young came in to do promo. I think it might have been for Harvest 2 or something like that. And there were probably about eight of us. And the chairman of the label asked Neil how the day had gone. He was a little bit grumpy, as he would be doing press all day. And he said, everybody always asks me about the lyrics. And I said to him, did they ask you about Emperor of Wyoming, which was the first track on his first solo album? Yes, exactly. And it really made him laugh. Yeah. That coupled with the Chardonnay, we turned the corner and it was a really lovely evening.
Right. And also early days. I mean, I'm just jumping from band to band here. Guns N' Roses. I mean, like at the very beginning, what was that? Was that gigs in England, was it?
Yeah, they came over and did the Marquee.
Right.
And they lived in Kensington, just off Kensington High Street. And when they left, the manager sent a dozen red roses.
Which was
I
great.
I also have my name as a thank you on Appetite for Destruction, but they spelt my name wrong.
Yeah, let's just get that right, because Appetite for Destruction, being the famous album, didn't come out till later. So you had known them quite well, and yet so they said thanks to you on the album, and they spelled the name wrong. That doesn't matter, does it?
No, I mean, so many people have it.
Yeah, right, and 30 million copies or something along those lines. Just Irish bands. Did you work at all with the Boomtown Rats?
I wrote about the Boomtown Rats. I love Tonic for the Troops.
Yeah, the second
and,
album.
And saw them live quite a bit and wrote about them for Sounds. I think I wrote about them for Sounds.
You worked with Neil Hannon when he was doing the cricket album, Duckworth Lewis.
Yeah, we still work with Neil Hannon. So we've worked with him for probably 10 years, if not more. But yeah, we did the two Duckworth Lewis records.
And when you say still work with, what's the company you have now? This is your own PR company.
Yeah, NBC. We've had this for 22 years now.
And who do you represent in that?
Oh, Foo Fighters, Depeche Mode, Rufus Wainwright, Pearl Jam, Kasabian, lots of people.
So it's just music?
Mostly music. We do some comedians as well. We work with Mo Gilligan.
And are you going to stay in London?
I live in London. It's my home.
No, I know that. Yeah, but there's no...
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not going anywhere.
You're not going back to Chicago or anything like that. Okay, so your favourite album, I know, is Exile on Main Street.
Yeah.
And your favourite track is Tumbling Dice. What is it about that album? I mean, were you a Stones fan in the 60s? Because remember, that's an early 70s album.
I was a Stones fan. A really big Stones fan. And, well, I guess Exile on Main Street is kind of like known as the Keith album, and also it's a double album. So if you could only take one album with you somewhere, it's got more tracks on it. It's just a great record. I love the kind of loose feel to it and the variety of the music, and I love Tumbling Dice. I don't know why. It just emotionally packs a punch.
It really does indeed. Just one or two last bits. Back to Madonna. Did you fall out with Madonna? Because she falls out with everybody. Back in 20...
No.
No. Because I thought, like Sarah Bernhardt says, nobody will ever stay friends with Madonna for all her life.
Well, the thing you have to realize is, you know, we're not friends. I work with her.
Yeah.
Like that great line in Almost Famous, when the Lester Bangs character says to the Cameron Crowe character, "These people aren't your friends."
Yeah, right. Just be warned as you go on the road.
Yeah,
yeah, indeed. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so you're not trying to be in this or in the Keith book revealing or sensationalist or anything. You're just telling the stories because you had the backstage access.
Exactly.
And just finally, would you have a favorite that you've worked with?
So many people. I'd say, you know, the last 5 years, I've been working with the Foo Fighters, and they're certainly one of my favorites.
Do you know, if they were to do an interview now, they would have to talk about Taylor Hawkins. I don't think they've done one since his death. Would that be a problem beforehand? Would you say that to either, you know, Dave Grohl?
No, you know, things that before when we were talking about things that happen in your personal life, you know, artists are people, and you have to take direction from what they feel.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And be sensitive to that.
Right, indeed. Well, listen, Barbara, I'm going to let you go, but one name I forgot to mention, I have to. Steve Marriott. Did you meet Steve Marriott? Did you work with him?
I interviewed him once when he was in Humble Pie.
Yeah.
And when I was first in England on an exchange program going to university here, and it was like the last interview of the day, and the poor guy was just like brain dead.
Did you like him?
Yeah, I was a big fan of Humble Pie. But, I mean, in terms of an interview, it wasn't like, I think he was probably just going through the motions.
Yeah, right. No, I just think the small faces are one of the all-time greats. Okay, well, listen, Barbara, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. And onwards and upwards, actually.
Thanks, Dave.
Access All Areas, a backstage pass through 50 years of music and culture. Barbara Sharone, and it's out now. Thanks, Barbara. See you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Dave Fanning on 2FM.